So our next presenter is Haley Cash, and Haley graduated from Brown University in 2011 with her PhD in pathobiology and MPH, where she focused on non-communicable disease in the Pacific. She's been in the Republic of Palau since 2012, where she works as an epidemiologist for the Palau Ministry of Health.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I'm going to shift our focus to the other side of the world and tell you about a relationship between maternal pre-pregnancy obesity and smokeless tobacco use and preterm delivery and low birth weight among Palauan women. So this work was actually done by a summer student of mine, Katie Berger, who is an MD MPH student at the Oregon Health and Science University. I think I got that right. She did a fantastic job this summer, and she couldn't make it here, so can everybody hear me? I'll be presenting her work for her. And I have nothing to disclose. So you're probably wondering, what is Palau? Where is Palau? So let me tell you. Palau is a small Pacific island nation just east of the Philippines. It's made up of over 340 islands with a total of 188 square miles of landmass. In 1994, Palau got its independence from the U.S. and currently has a compact of free association with the U.S. The population is 17,500 now that I'm here in Boston. So that's slightly more than the people attending this conference, just to put that into perspective for you. So it's a very small island nation. The per capita income is about $5,000, which makes Palau a middle-income country. Keep in mind here that many Palauans still rely on fully or partially on subsistence living, and the amount of poverty in Palau is actually very, very low. It also has one of the lowest GDPs in the world, mostly due to its small population, and the largest sector is public administration due to a large amount of foreign aid from various countries. About 70% of the population is made up of native Palauans. The second largest group are Filipinos, which make up about 15% of the population. And the two national languages are English and Palauan, and most native Palauans grow up fluent in both, so it's a very comfortable place to work and live. So if you haven't been to Palau, this is where I live. These are our beautiful rock islands where you can find the best scuba diving in the world, and when Katie was not in the office, this is what Katie was doing. So I'll tell you a little bit about our project. We were using on-island prenatal and birth records from 2007 and 2013 to look at a couple of risk factors of interest. The first is betel nut with tobacco chewing, which I'm going to go over in just a few minutes because I'm assuming most people don't know what that is, as well as pre-pregnancy obesity. These are both really big problems in Palau, which is one of the reasons we wanted to focus on them. Also, as a lot of you probably know, a lot of the literature is focused on tobacco exposure via cigarette smoking as opposed to chewing, whereas on this side of the world, our side of the world, most women actually chew tobacco. And we wanted to look at these risk factors and their effects on preterm delivery and low birth weight. So our study sample was made up of just under 1,200 Palauan women who gave birth on island between 2007 and 2011. Data, like I said, was collected from prenatal and birth records collected at the Palau National Hospital, our only hospital in the country. So just to bring you through our sample, we started off with a little over 1,600 women. These were all of the births in that time period. We excluded all women who were non-Palauans for various reasons. We also excluded women who gave birth prior to 20 weeks of gestation, women who had stillbirths, and women who gave birth to twins. We also excluded women who were missing data on some of our variables we were looking at, so parity, age, education, marriage, and pre-pregnancy BMI. We also excluded women who were missing data on tobacco use, as well as three women who reported smoking during pregnancy, and one woman who reported betel nut only use without tobacco. Those would have been interesting exposures, but you can't do very much with one in three women. We also excluded women who were missing gestational age and birth weight of their babies. So this left us with our about 1,200 women. So in our study, we defined normal birth, a normal birth as a birth with a gestation of 37 to 41 weeks and a birth weight over 2,500 grams or 5 pounds, 8 ounces. So our adverse birth outcomes were preterm birth, so a birth less than 37 weeks, a low birth weight, which is a birth weight less than 2,500 grams, and we also looked at low birth weight for full-term deliveries, so babies who were less than 2,500 grams who were born to moms who made it full-term. So just to go over our sample, about a quarter of these women delivered at advanced maternal age, so were 35 or older. About a quarter of the women had less than a high school education. About half of these women were unmarried, which is not too uncommon in Palau, where culturally a lot of women get married after they give birth to their first baby. About a third of the women were first-time moms, and over when we looked at our risk factors of interest, we found that over three-quarters of women reported that they chewed betel nut with tobacco during pregnancy. And about a third of these women were obese prior to being pregnant. So let me go over betel nut now. So betel nut is found, it grows throughout Southeast Asia and the Pacific. So it's this little green nut you see here. Different nations have different ways of preparing their betel nut chew. In Palau, how it's typically prepared is people will cut the nut in half, scoop out the soft center, and they'll add lime, which is made from crushed coral, to activate the ricolin in the nut. Then, traditionally, that would just be wrapped in a pepper leaf, and that would be chewed. In the past few decades, people have started adding tobacco, mostly via cigarettes, to their chew. So they'll chew that whole carcinogenic mixture, essentially. So the betel nut itself is considered a carcinogen, and then almost everybody who chews also adds cigarettes now. So this is a really common practice in Palau and other nations. So people will do it throughout the day, like drinking coffee in the States. Most people typically prepare a chew about every half hour to an hour, and it's common to chew about half a pack of cigarettes to a whole pack of cigarettes a day. So like I said before, 76% of our pregnant Palauan women reported that they chewed betel nut with tobacco throughout their pregnancy. In our sample, chewers were statistically, were significantly more likely to be obese. They were more likely to be unmarried, more likely to have less than a high school education, and have a higher parity. When we examined obesity in our sample, we found that 59% of pregnant women had a high BMI, 29% were overweight, so a BMI between 25 and less than 30, and 30% were obese, so they had a BMI greater than 30. And in our sample, obese women were significantly more likely to be older, more educated, unmarried, have a higher parity, and also to be chewers. So we did see a lot of overlap between our obese women and our chewers. So in all of our models, which I'll show you in a few, we did control for both risk factors. We tried to look at the overlap of these risk factors, but unfortunately our sample size was too small. So when we examined our adverse birth outcomes in our sample, we found that 9.1% of women gave birth preterm, and 8.2% of babies were born low birth weight, and 3.9% of babies were born low birth weight to full-term moms. So we started off looking at our risk factors and our outcomes just using a simple chi-square analysis. So when we examined obesity by our outcomes, we found that obese women had higher rates of preterm birth than non-obese women, so about 12% versus 8%, which was statistically significant. However, we did not see any difference between obese and non-obese women when it came to birth weight. When we examined tobacco use, so this is the tobacco chewing, We found that our chewers were more likely to have a low birth weight than our non-chewers, so about 9% versus 6%, which was not significant. We then wanted to look at, we wanted to stratify our mothers by full term versus preterm to look at low birth weight by chewers versus non-chewers. We found that this relationship was stronger when we looked at our full term only moms, suggesting that this is perhaps something to do with growth restriction rather than smaller babies due to a preterm birth. So in our models, which I'll show you in the next slide, we restricted our moms to full-term only moms when we examined birth weight. So we use multivariate logistic regression to build our models. When we examined our low birth weight outcome in full-term moms, we found that chewers were 2.4 times more likely to have a low birth weight baby than non-chewers, which was significant. And when we looked at preterm delivery as an outcome, we found that obese moms were 1.5 times more likely to have a preterm birth than non-obese moms. And these models all controlled for advanced maternal age, parity, education, and marital status. So to conclude, we found that more than 3/4 of Palauan women are chewing tobacco with betel nut during their pregnancy. And we found that women who chew during their pregnancy were 2.4 times more likely to have a low birth weight baby at full term than women who didn't chew during pregnancy. And about 1/3 of Palauan women are obese prior to getting pregnant, and women who were obese prior to getting pregnant were 1.5 times more likely to have a preterm delivery than women who were not obese prior to pregnancy. So we have a few projects that we want to work on from here, a few next steps. The first would be to develop better data collection protocols. It would be great if we could actually quantify chewing and figure out how much tobacco women were actually being exposed to. Also, we didn't have data in our data set about blood pressure and blood sugar among these women, which would be interesting to look at, you know, obesity-related factors rather than just obesity itself. We'd like to also assess the long-term effects in these children. Additionally, look at tobacco exposure via breast milk. Almost all of these women are going to go on to breastfeed their babies and continue to use tobacco during breastfeeding. So it would be interesting to look at, you know, this in utero and breast milk exposure to tobacco. And of course, we want to develop prevention and intervention programs for these women. And it would be great if we could examine the effects of betel nut with and without tobacco in other places, because not all nations add tobacco at this point. So it'd be nice to be able to determine whether or not how much of these effects are tobacco and how much are the betel nuts themselves. So with that, I'd like to once again thank Katie, who did a fantastic job on this project, as well as a few folks at the Ministry of Health in Palau. So, thank you.
Okay, well, we have very efficient presenters and very interesting papers. So we'll open up now and have questions. So any questions from the audience? Yes.
Sure, that's a really good question. So betel nut itself, like I said, was traditionally chewed without the tobacco, and it was traditionally a ceremonious thing done mostly by elders. So it's kind of a cultural tradition that's been morphed into something bad. So now people are, you know, doing it regularly, doing it throughout the day, and adding tobacco. So, you know, there's a push in Palau, and I think other places, to not get rid of it, but to bring it back to its original cultural values. And, you know, it does hold a place in Palauan culture, but it's not being used to that traditional sense right now. Oh, sure. Sorry. So she asked why these women are chewing. Most Palauans actually chew, you know, from really young ages, and they're adding tobacco from those young ages. So, you know, by the time they become pregnant, it's just a habit, and they're addicted, and there's not a stigma against chewing in the first place, never mind chewing during pregnancy. So a lot of it's just raising awareness and making women aware that, you know, there are health effects. Thank you.
So the question, if I'm understanding it, is did we look at just community level characteristics overall in the city of Richmond, not specifically in the public housing development?
Well, in different geographic ways, so as opposed to proximity to public housing, but, you know, kind of where the property is or where the...
Right, yes. And yes, we did look at that a little bit. And I believe that looking at some other research that I've done, there are... most of the areas that are surrounding the housing developments have the block groups and census tracts with the highest level of, you know, percent of residents living in poverty, like the less educated residents. You know, they're all kind of concentrated in the same areas. This particular research didn't look at that because we really were focusing more on just the, you know, looking at the proximity to housing. But, you know, I think that it's... definitely an interesting idea that we could look at in the future.
Actually, while you're up there, if I could add a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, and maybe you presented it and I just missed it, but I was wondering, how did you determine, what was the rationale for the different zones?
So the question was, what was the rationale for the distance, different buffer zone distances? And really, they just, you know, we didn't want to have something that was too, you know, too broad to capture everything. You know, we want to have kind of more finer increments. Another research that we have done using the same data set actually used the Euclidean distance from public housing developments to each birth, or I guess the maternal place of residence for each birth. So we actually looked at it that way. This is sort of a simplified method of that, and it really was because, you know, I think that the results are still... you know, while we did lose significance on a couple of the measures in the models, I think that it gets the general idea, and I think it's a lot easier to comprehend the you know, the buffer zones rather than saying, you know, if you're 0.5 miles away from a, you know, housing development, you have this increased risk. So it's more for you know, to help people understand and facilitate learning. So, mm-hmm.
I have a question for you.
Sure. Sure. So the question was asking more about the paternal presence and how that might have affected either women and families living in the housing developments, and also, I guess, just in general, how it affected the birth outcomes. And So we're limited because we only have the data that is on the birth, the birth record, which in Virginia they list a child as either being legitimate or illegitimate. And you know, obviously, if someone's, you know, if there's a father's name on the birth certificate, then they're considered legitimate. And so we, you know, said that their paternal presence was there. There are probably aspects where the father is involved in, you know, in the financial and social support aspects of raising a child. However, you know, they might not be formally married or formally living together because of those, you know, income restrictions and things like that. So obviously we don't have any data to capture that, but it is a possibility that, you know, that that's in there, that some families are maybe, you know, not getting married because of that, so that the mother and the family can and the children can stay in the housing developments. There's just no way to tell just with the data that we have, but it's certainly a possibility. Sure. I know at least for our research in Richmond, Virginia, or I guess I should say the question was about, I guess just the definition of race in general and how we use it in research. And while that is a very broad comment, and I can't specifically, you know, talk about everything about it. Right. And I think that I think it's important, especially in public health research, to be able to have a category, you know, to be able to categorize people in the sense of, you know, there are certain risk factors that are, you know, associated with one race versus another. In our situation in Richmond, about half of the residents, like 50%, are Black or African American. We do have very, low percentages of Hispanic or other population other than, being white, Caucasian, or Black African American. In this analysis, we did consider Hispanic ethnicity as an independent variable because there weren't enough of them to be able to have them as their own category. But we did look at them, and they had similar birth outcomes as white women did, and actually in some instances a little bit better outcomes than white women. But I think in general it's difficult, and as you said, you know, it's, a lot of people, especially nowadays, have, you know, are multi-ethnic and, you know, have a lot of very diverse racial background. So I guess in particular in our city, just because we have such a large population of Black and African Americans, that, you know, it works for us. I can't speak to any, you know, how it is in Michigan, or, you know, I suppose in Palau you have the Palauans, but yeah, I don't know if you guys want to talk about that in there.
So for our study, part of the reason that we chose to use the hospitalization data as opposed to the database of all reportable conditions in Michigan is that we thought we could get at race a little bit better because we were hoping it would be self-reported from the medical record. I understand what you're saying, but I think for us, our goal was to figure out populations that need to be targeted first and interventions that need to be designed first. We don't have a whole lot of resources in this area right now. So to that extent, it's important to get educational materials out there, you know, to certain populations first, and then when we can expand, great. But I think for intervention-wise, it's at least a start at getting at the most vulnerable groups. I don't know if that answers it, but...
Well, I'm not sure that you all can answer that. Families, as far as racial background, that sort of thing. So it, I think it is very
frequency, intensity, et cetera, of fetal blood use. But at this point, would you be able to roughly say of the pregnant women, were they medium users, heavy users, light users?
So the question was, do we have any data to show the intensity of tobacco use right now? And the short answer is no. Unfortunately, you know, it's just kind of a, women are coded as either not using any tobacco at all, chewing betel nut without tobacco, chewing with tobacco, or smoking. That's all we have right now, but we're working on revising our forms and collecting better data.